This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After serving their time, more than two-thirds of U.S. prisoners are likely to end up back in prison. Tomorrow, what can prisons do to prevent recidivism? And should someone be held accountable if ex-cons reoffend? That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. President Bush is now in Egypt for a summit with Arab leaders. He's seeking their support for the U.S.-backed roadmap, which is intended to bring the Palestinian-Israeli conflict to an end. After talks in Egypt on Tuesday, President Bush will travel to a landmark summit with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and his Palestinian counterpart Mahmoud Abbas. The goal, of course, is to end violence in the Middle East, but if history is any example, the peace process itself is a time when violence often intensifies. Joining us now from his home in Port Stewart, Northern Ireland, is John Darby, a professor of comparative ethnic studies at the University of Notre Dame and the author of The Effects of Violence on Peace Processes. And it's very good of you to be with us.
Glad to be here.
Why does violence increase during peace negotiations?
In one sense, it doesn't increase, but it changes. Most peace processes begin by the declaration of a ceasefire, and the word itself implies that fighting stops. And often what does stop is the traditional form of violence, security forces on the one hand, paramilitaries or militants on the other. And the ceasefire marks the agreement to go into negotiations between those two groups. But what often happens is that the violence transforms itself into other forms during the process of negotiations, and it becomes a constant backcloth and a constant problem while people are trying to come to an agreement.
Now, you've identified three different forms of violence that can threaten a peace process. Why don't we begin, go through them in order. Violence by the state.
Well, this is the one which quite often is most ignored. But in fact, very often governments are as unwilling to go into peace talks as their opponents. Even when they agree to go into it, there are often elements within the government, the traditional, who are less enthusiastic about the idea. So there's often a dispute between the security side of government and the government side itself, the main administration. It's not unusual for the security side to continue its operations on the basis that the talks may fail, and it's their duty to ensure that they do their job in case the war resumes.
And this is wrapped up in the idea of why are we negotiating with these terrorists, whoever they may be, anyway?
It always underlies, any government going into negotiations. I mean, the other problem by government is that one of the consequences of a successful peace accord or peace negotiations is that you start reducing the number of soldiers and military and policemen. So people are going to lose jobs. These people have become potential underminers of the process itself if they align themselves with militants.
Well, how do peace negotiators deal with the question of violence by the state?
Well, in some ways, this is the most difficult of all the forms of violence to deal with, because the state itself has control very often of the sources of information that are coming out and so on. And a particular onus falls on outsiders, I think, to inform the world about abuses by states. And that falls on the media, on NGOs, on organizations like Amnesty International and others.
Now, the next issue you raise is violence by militants, and these would be presumably elements of the rebel group of whatever faction it is, but they feel that they're not being taken into account or that they're being sold out somehow?
Yeah, there's a tendency to view militants as monolithic, and they never are. There are always groups within. If a militant group decides to go into negotiations, there are always members of their group who will regard this as a sellout and who will carry on the torch, quite often literally carry on the torch, during the negotiations themselves in an attempt to spoil the negotiations. So you have breakaway groups who themselves can threaten the process. And, of course, another threat is that the people who enter into negotiations may find the negotiations are not going along the direction they want and may abandon their ceasefires. In fact, most peace negotiations fail for that reason.
Now, you describe four different types of militants. Dealers who will negotiate, zealots who view compromise as betrayal and therefore regard dealers as traitors, opportunists who might be induced to participate in negotiations at some future date, and mavericks who will continue to engage in violence for non-political reasons such as profit and self-aggrandizement. Certainly not a monolith, just those four groups, subgroups.
Yeah, the difficulty is that you cannot, I think, guarantee guarantee that everyone at any given moment in time will say, well, we'll stop fighting now, we've got what we want. And the object must be to try to draw into the talks, if possible, as many people as can be drawn into them, to marginalize those who think that it's a betrayal, and as far as possible, to remove the military situation into one which can be dealt with by the courts.
So the rule of law in that case.
The rule of law.
Right. Now, the third possibility of violence that you identify is violence from within the community. And I guess as a way of example, there in Northern Ireland, a fairly regular incidents of stoning by groups of Protestant or Catholic boys.
Yeah, this is just the beginning. I'm in Northern Ireland at the moment, and this is just the beginning of the what we call the marching season, which is when traditionally groups of nationalists and unionists come into situations where they confront each other, temperature rises, and it's a bad time to start negotiations. But it's even more noted in other places where even after an agreement has been successfully made, you often find that the heritage of the violence which has gone on before spills over into an increase in violent crime, for example, such as you've had in South Africa, Guatemala, El Salvador. In Northern Ireland, it looked as if that wasn't going to happen for a time after the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, but there are now signs that here, too, violent crime is increasing. And it's to do with a variety of reasons. I think custom of violence, the presence of weapons, presence of people who know how to use them.
There is also a phrase that I picked up when I was covering Northern Ireland, was that inevitably you always got to the politics of the latest atrocity.
Yeah.
Politicians were always blindsided by whatever bomb it was that went off wherever, and either, you know, how can you possibly defend those murdering thugs, or how can we possibly talk to the murdering thugs who just did that?
Well, one of the more encouraging lessons, I think, from the Northern Ireland process is that as time passes and the atrocities become much more unlikely to overturn the process as time passes. So at the beginning, embryonic negotiations are very vulnerable to particular atrocities. And if you're someone who wants to undermine the talks, this is a good time to plan your violence. But as time goes by, if the negotiations continue to be relatively successful, a kind of asbestos sheet surrounds the negotiators, and they're much more able to put up with and to last out this sort of initiative. I think it would be quite difficult to imagine in Northern Ireland, for example, at the moment, a particular atrocity, no matter how bad it is, misdirecting the process in another way. I think other things could do it, but not so much that.
Yet in the situation that we're in right now, the president and the various leaders in the Middle East, the phrase I think that the White House has used, the summit meeting will go ahead if conditions allow, that would seem to suggest that your point is quite accurate, that embryonic negotiations are very vulnerable.
Well, in the Middle East in particular, I think, because I think people are very skilled at in trying to assess the temperature among the population and to decide how it can be undermined if they want to do it. I take the view that when you have a large number of people fighting and even risking suicide, risking their own lives, it's usually because they feel that they don't have any option but this. So as far as possible, try to find a way of giving them an option.
John Darby, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Pleasure.
John Darby, a professor of comparative ethnic studies at the University of Notre Dame and the author of The Effects of Violence on Peace Processes. Here are some of today's headlines from NPR News. As we noted before, President Bush has left the summit of the G8 economic powers to talk peace in the Middle East. He's now in Egypt, where he'll meet this week with Arab leaders and later on with Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers. And today the FCC voted to relax limits on media ownership, though some proponents of deregulation say the commission did not go far enough. We'll hear more later today from NPR's Rick Carr and NPR's Michael Sullivan on All Things Considered. Right now, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.